Like many, I look forward to the next Helen Garner book, be it one of her rare novels or a very fine non-fiction, which over the years has given us gems like The Joe Shinque Consolation and This House of Grief, that dark courtroom drama about the father who drove his kids into a dam. When I spoke to her, Helen had a newie out called Everywhere I Look. Well, a newie, but in a sense an oldie, a collection of essays on everything from getting older to the appeal of dogs to Russell Crowe's acting. So here she is, Helen Garner. Congratulations on winning something called the Wyndham Campbell Prize. I understand you almost missed the notification.
Yes, it would appear in my spam folder. And I just happened to be browsing through that, and there was this strange message, an email from the United States, and I immediately thought it was a hoax because it asked for my phone number. But I just made a quick inquiry of my publisher, and he told me that it wasn't a hoax and that I should send them my phone number, so I did.
And it was a loud hail from Yale.
Yeah, exactly. It was quite shocking. I still can't get my head around it.
But you told the SMH that you felt this prize, this particular prize, was a validation. Do you still need validation?
Well, my work goes in two streams, really. There's a certain amount of fiction, and then there's some non-fiction. And I've won the odd prize for fiction. But I've never won a prize in Australia for non-fiction. And, there are those three books you mentioned, The First Stone, Joe Chinque's Consolation, and This House of Grief. And apart from a wonderful little outfit called the Crime Writers Association of Australia, who gave me a Ned Kelly Award, I don't sort of get noticed in prize season. And, I hate to sound a whinger, but it's the whole thing of prizes has exercised me quite a lot this last year.
Well, Helen, one of the reasons you need and deserve prizes is because I'm painfully aware of the way the sky falls on you with a lot of your non-fiction books. They get you into terrible trouble.
Yeah, the sky falls. That's actually a good image. While I was waiting to talk to you tonight, I ran into a chap who works at the ABC. He just was walking past with a bottle of milk, and if in the lobby, and he was also at the Robert Farquharson trials that I wrote about in This House of Grief, and we were terribly pleased to see each other, and we had a long and interesting conversation about how traumatic it is to spend a lot of time in courts, and he suggested that the love of courts, that is being in a court to write about cases, is an addiction, and I think he might be right. So he said several things that gave me a lot of food for thought.
I don't know if you remember this, but your book on Joe Shinque sent me off to talk to his parents for a day or so, and to the young woman responsible for his death. And I learn with, I think, mixed feelings that it's being made into either a movie or a miniseries. Are you involved in that?
No, I'm not. I know the person who's, I now know the director. It's a film. It's not for TV. It's a feature. I sold the rights. He approached me. Several people had approached me, and I didn't like the idea of doing it. But this person approached me, and in a slightly different tone of voice. And the movie's. I'm not sure when it's coming out, but it's almost finished, I think.
At the centre of books like Chinque and House of Grief, there is, in some terrible way, love. Robert Farquharson loved his kids, yet he drowned them. And you, in fact, feel very clearly, we're not talking about monsters, we're talking about people whose feet slip on the ladder. Oh, hang on, you've got another metaphor. The foot goes through the floorboards.
Yes, well, I was quite interested after I published This House of Grief about Farquharson that there were people who said they flatly refused to read the book because nowhere in that book had I said that Robert Farquharson was a monster. And I thought a great deal about this. I thought, why do people need to be told that a person like him is a monster? It's as if people have some need for him to be not human, that they don't want to belong to the same order of creation as the one he does. That's unbearable to them, and so they need some sort of trumpeting, a lot of moral trumpeting, in order to make it bearable for them to contemplate such a crime. That I wouldn't find that very interesting to do. Besides, I don't feel like trumpeting doesn't seem to me an adequate response. Moral trumpeting. It's quite boring.
Well, you people seem to think that crime is driven by hatred or even evil with a capital E, but too often, as you describe to us, it's a confusion growing out of love.
Yes, and I've in the book I've talked about the strange idea that kept coming up in the trial, in some of the evidence. People would say, but he loved those boys. They would passionately declare that they knew that he'd loved his sons, as if that would prove that he couldn't possibly have hurt them or killed them. But as I've written here and there, that's just a sentimental fantasy, that love is a peaceful realm where we're safe from our destructive urges. It's not. It's otherwise there wouldn't be all the songs that we love, all the songs about the pain of love and the brutality of rejection. And
well, there aren't many happy love songs, are there?
No. I suppose there might be a few, but I don't know any.
Yeah. You've written in the new book and others of the conflicted emotions you have for people whom you love, your parents, your close friend who came to stay with you when you were dying. Let's talk about some of those. You write that it's difficult for you to write extensively about your mum. Why is that?
Well, my feelings for her were very complicated. I think a lot of smart, educated women of my generation found that their relationship with their mother became untenable at a certain point, that there was you passed your mother. You're in a faster lane than your mother has ever existed in, and some disruption happens, and it can be terribly painful, especially when you think that your mother is actually afraid of you, or that you are her intellectual superior. All the power balances shift in an awful way the older you get, and I found that very painful with my mother, and I feel the essay that I wrote about her, which is in this new book, Everywhere I Look, it cost me a lot to write it. I'd been commissioned to write it for a book that Susan Windham was editing about our generation and their parents, and I found it excruciating to write. It was almost like going through some kind of psychoanalytic sieve. I found it. I had to face things about myself that were very unappealing and even downright ugly. And I thought, if I could just get these into words, maybe they won't haunt me. I suffer from a great deal of guilt when I think about my mother. And indeed, I have found that writing that essay did bring me some sort of resolution, because I was able to articulate the love that I have for her as well, and how I miss her, and how sometimes I long to see her again so I could try to make up to her the times when I was really cruel to her, I suppose, as people sometimes are to their parents.
You quote Hilary Mantel, who says that the world moves on so fast, we lose all chance of being the women our mothers were. We lose all understanding of what shaped them. That's a very, very sad quote.
It is sad. It's pained. And I greatly admire Hilary Mantel. I think she doesn't shrink from saying the painful truth.
I talked to her at some length, and she was quietly impressive. And, of course, her own life, her own backstory, is turbulent and in many ways tormented.
Yes, awful illness that she's had. But I think she's a fabulous writer. I'm an enormous admirer of hers.
You write that you regret never having sat down with Mum and asking about her life before she met your dad. Were you close to him?
Not really, but close in a different way, in the sense that we fought each other from about the moment I was, I suppose, a teenager until about 3 years before he died. We were locked in struggle, me and my father, because I was the eldest of six kids, and I think, I was the one they, like all first children, I was the one that was practiced on. That's how they learnt to be parents. And he was a very pugnacious kind of person and once again, not educated, left school at 15. And it's a painful thing to be a lot more educated than your parents are.
In a way, you expiate the guilt of others, of your readers, because your writing is a relief to them who've had complicated relationships with their families.
Yes, well, I'm...
In other words, you're their therapist.
Well, I wouldn't claim that, but it is true sometimes that I know that I read that other writers that I've read have articulated things in me that I hadn't been able to put into words myself, and not just writers either, but just people you meet. Like, for example, the journalist I met in the lobby here before I was talking to you tonight. Just the fact that he could articulate things about how terrible it is to sit in courts, and I mean, it's sort of gripping, but ultimately terrible and somehow destructive to one's soul to sit through trials that go on for a long time. It's such a relief that somebody else has felt things and that you aren't alone with it.
Ellie Nell on RN, and you can listen live or via podcast on your phone or tablet, and I'm talking with author Helen Garner. I suddenly have a flashback to an opening night at the Comedy Theatre in Melbourne when David Williamson was surrounded by friends and family, and by the end of the play, I don't think he had any friends left. They were all up on stage, and it was like being at Elsinore, you know, watching the play within the play. And that raises an issue that affects you directly, because you're incredibly unsentimental very often when you're writing, and you've often found yourself at odds with the people you're writing about or have written about. Friends, colleagues have said that they felt that their life was used for material. Now, you think a lot about this in the new book.
Yes, I haven't... when I was writing fiction was when I came across problems of that sort.
Going back to Monkey Grip, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I just had an email this morning from the original of Jarvo the Junkie in Monkey Grip. I mean, what I found is that you write about people and sometimes they're outraged for a while, but years pass. And if you haven't written about them with vengeance in mind... sometimes the anger and pain are resolved. And furthermore, not all that many people have complained to me. Several have, and I have actually fallen out with one person.
Well, let me cite one, and that's Alan Gregory, the academic at the Centre of the First Stone, who reported feeling devastated by your portrayal of him, although, of course, you were sympathetic to him.
I was, yes. Don't know what to say about that.
You often quote Janet Malcolm and that famous maxim about journalism, quote, every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible. He or she is a kind of confidence man preying on people's vanity, ignorance or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse. I've had a lifelong abhorrence of invading privacy as a broadcaster, but you have to dig much, much deeper in a book than I do in a 20-minute chat.
Yes, well, of course, that opening sentence of The Journalist and the Murderer by Janet Malcolm is really a kind of trumpet blast to It's like a trumpeter rushing out at the beginning of a play and blowing a tremendous blast to get attention, and it really describes the blackest side of journalism, the blackest version of it. And I think I think it's a tremendous overstatement, and a lot of very good and very well known journalists that I know were absolutely furious and enraged when she published that, and they thought it was a terrible slur on the profession. But yes, the thing is, to me, who owns a story? See, when you start to talk about this, there obviously a sort of a split occurs between fiction and non-fiction. But a story is not something that's just lying around on the ground waiting to be picked up and put into a book. A story is a whole lot of disparate chunks of stuff, and a writer comes along and picks them up and looks at them carefully and tries to put them together in some kind of meaningful pattern, which will actually relieve the anxiety that people feel in the face of certain painful events. I don't think stories belong to people, really, and particularly not when they become the subject of a court case or a trial. I think once they go into a court, then they belong to all of us.
And all of us can be in this vast jury.
Yes, and of course, the thing is that nobody's really, no man is an island. Everybody's connected to everyone else by a million filaments that are so fine that we don't even know they're there. And that's why we're so interested in these stories, because they're about us as well. They're not just about a bloke who, spins the wheel and takes his car into a dam with all his kids in it. These stories are about all our destructive urges that we're terrified to examine.
Well, let's, in the few minutes we have left, let's talk about our story, you and I, because we share the same plot of suddenly finding that we're rather old. Now, I'm a few years older than you, but one of the joys in the new collection is that you muse and are amused by the insults of age.
Yes. Yeah, well, I published that an article, a little essay in the monthly magazine about some things that happened when I realised that it was actually not so terrible to get old if you got out there on the street and, well, to put it crudely, kicked ass. And I enjoyed writing that essay so much. I laughed out loud while I was writing. And usually writers consider it to be a bit dangerous if you're laughing while you're writing. There's probably not going to be much laughing when people are reading it. But Still people getting in touch with me saying how much it made them laugh, because I just sort of managed to spit the dummy in certain situations where I once, as a slightly younger woman, would have gone to water and faded out and let people behave towards me in outrageous or insulting ways. But just last year and the year before, I sort of got a grip, and I now walk around the world making a pest of myself. To some extent.
You wrote years ago that one of the consolations of getting on a bit was that you were out of the sexual marketplace, which means you could have real friendships with men. Are you still out of the marketplace?
Totally. Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing to be an older woman, because in many situations you're sort of untouchable, unless the person's a psychopath, God forbid. But, you're not a threat to anyone except in your crabbiness, and you're just pointing out the truth of a situation in a rather loud voice. And that's the best fun I've had for years.
You speak for both of us when you say you've become less judgmental, less quick to judge people. I think that's one of the great advantages of slipping into dotage.
Yes, that you don't feel so sort of... You can see all sides of a question, and that could turn you into a wimp, I suppose, but by the same token, it's much more interesting when you see things in the round and you've got a lot of experience and a lot of other things to compare each new experience with, and so everything becomes richer and more interesting.
I'm interested, in fact, I think I'm a bit astonished that you've agreed to become the subject of a biography. What are the terms of reference?
Oh no, it's not a biography. It's a literary. It's supposed to be a literary study of my work. Someone's doing. It's not a biography.
Oh, but come on, well, you know, in your case, when your life and your work blend and blur, Bernadette Brennan is going to find that pretty tricky.
Well, perhaps she will or perhaps she won't, because there's Helen Garner, who's an actual person that, you know, goes about, cooking and eating and watering the garden. And then there's the Helen Garner in quotes, who is the person, the persona that inhabits my work. And they're not the same.
I wouldn't suggest they were identical, but I do still argue that there is a bit of blurring. You're threatened from time to time to burn your diaries and your letters, and the National Archives contact you to say, don't you dare. So you kept them for the moment.
Oh, yes. I burnt everything up to about the year 1980, but I've got everything still since then, and I'm not planning to burn it anyway. You're not allowed to burn things anymore. No one's allowed to have an incinerator in their backyard, so where the hell would you burn it?
I've never thought of it as a climate change problem.
Yeah,
Helen,
it is.
It's great to talk to you. The last time we talked was on the odd subject of angels, and they didn't come up tonight. Helen Garner, author of most lately, the collection Everywhere I Look, published by Text, and the Little Wireless Program. Thanks her for her time.